This is episode number 790 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about our Terrificon trip this past weekend, a new Joker movie that's in the works, the Jetsons coming to ABC, the return of Wizard, and more. Our comics this week will be Lilith Dark number 1, Mr. Miracle number 1, Hi-Fi Fight Club number 1, and TMNT Usagi Yojimbo.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well and looking forward to actually talking about some really good comics.
I am excited about that, too. And the excitement is in part due to the fact that we are still coming down.
Yes.
From this past weekend that we spent at Terrificon. As we record this, we were 4 days ago at Terrificon 2017 at Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut. Of course, our good friend Mr. Mitch Halleck put on another amazing show. Every year, we think about how the show is going to get better.
Yep.
Or you know, you worry for shows that you love. Like, is it going to be able to maintain this? Is it going to keep...
There's going
to
be a drop.
You know,
there's going to be a drop.
Is it going to go in the wrong direction? Nope. The show was great
yep.
this year, just as it was great last year, and it was great the year before. You know, Mitch really does a fantastic job of balancing the emphasis on comic books with the desire of some fans to come in and see celebrities. And he just makes really good choices about who he brings to the shows. In particular, this year, I brought my son on Saturday and his friend who had never been to a con before. And so Parker has come with me to a number of cons at this point. And we have reminisced in the past about how we met John Wesley Shipp and how he's super awesome. And we met the actress who plays Nyssa on Arrow last year, and that was super great as well. Well, this year they had Violet Bean from The Flash, who plays Jesse Quick. And both my son and his friend wanted to meet her. And so, of course, Saturday morning, you know, right when the show opened, we went over, we got to her table. We were like fifth or sixth in line, and she came in, and she was fantastic. And that, to me, is what I love about the guests that Mitch brings to the show, is he does his research.
Yes.
And he finds out, who are the guests that are really good at interacting with fans? Who are the guests that are generally considered to be nice people and that will give people a good experience? And so, you know, I was joking with the kids in line, like, hey, you guys, when we get up to take our picture here, you know, she's probably going to ask you guys some questions. So, like, don't freak out and be all starstruck. Of course they were.
Yeah.
But when we got up to meet Violet Bean, she was asking the kids, like, so, you know, were you guys psyched about this last season? What did you think of it? Are you ready for the next season? And sort of what are you excited about? And of course they were like, oh, yeah, it was great. Yeah, super awesome. It was great. But she was fantastic. She took a great picture with us and the kids. And it was super fun to meet her. They also ran into Echo Kellum, who plays Mr. Terrific. They were walking around the show and they happened to end up walking with him and ended up having like a mini conversation with him. So they were like just blown away. And of course, Shannon Purser, who plays Barb on Stranger Things and also plays Ethel on Riverdale, they ended up, I wasn't with them at the time, but they ended up going and getting a picture taken with her and talking to her, and she was super nice as well. And so that's always a great gauge for me, is what my son mm-hmm. or his friends think about the show and the type of time that they had. They absolutely loved it. There was a game room upstairs that they could go play with other kids for hours, different video games and stuff like that. They got to walk around and meet people in Artist Alley. They met a couple of the celebrities that were there, and it was a fantastic experience for them, which makes it a good experience
yes.
for me as well. But of course, you and I couldn't be at the table all the time because we were doing panels all weekend. And so you did a couple of panels and I did a couple of panels. What were the ones that you did?
So you and I did a How to Do a Podcast panel with our
right.
good friend Lewis from Angry Geeks.
Which was super awesome because the funny thing is like Mitch will set up panels and he doesn't always tell you like who's on it or like whatever. So, you know, Lewis gets there and we get there and we're like, oh, we're on this panel together. Awesome. And so it was cool to, and that was like right in the beginning of the day on Friday.
Yeah. My parents sat in on it.
Yes. Classic.
I got to walk around the show with my parents, which was a lot of fun. You were talking about bringing your son. I'm bringing my parents and they're meeting everybody. And...
But it was like the first time that they've ever, because your parents are not avid listeners of Secret Identity.
Nope.
So this was the first time for the two of them to be sitting there watching us two morons.
Yes.
Up in front of a room full of people talking about making podcasts or talking about the thing that we've been doing for the past 12 years.
Yeah. And so then the next one that I did was we were celebrating what would be the 100th birthday of Jack Kirby.
Right.
So I did a panel with legendary comic writer Roy Thomas.
Who is a hot ticket.
Yes. And he could not have been any cooler. I didn't know Roy had any Jack Kirby stories. So I thought it was just going to be two morons talking about how awesome Jack Kirby is. And he had story after story after story. So it was great. A lot of fun there. Very well attended, too.
Well, and you love those panels where you have a guest that needs very little prompting to sort of go into storytelling mode because, you know, these panels are like roughly 45 minutes long. And if you have someone who's not a talker, that can be a little rough as a moderator. But if you have someone who wants to launch into stories, it's like you point them in a direction and go.
Yeah. And then my favorite one that I got to do, and this is always my favorite ones, is I got to do a Stan Sakai Usagi Yojimbo panel.
Oh, yes.
So we spent 45 minutes just talking about our favorite rabbit. The audience there, a great, great audience, and people that had a ton of questions. Problem with that panel is I had a ton of questions. So that's where you really start to draw the line where you want to do your thing for like 10 minutes just to get everybody kind of fired up and worked up. And you're looking up and you see a hand coming up and it's like, all right, I got to call on this guy.
I know. It's hard. Dude, it's hard because I'm like you. You know, with certain creators that we get to spend time with, it's like I could ask you 4 hours worth of questions myself. And obviously Stan Sakai is one of the nicest human beings on the planet.
Absolutely.
So he is exactly the type of guy that you want to do a panel with, but everybody has a million questions for him. So.
And it was a lot of fun. It was great. And you and I always talk about when we get that response back from somebody either on the panel, somebody that was witnessing it. Stan's wife came up to me and said, wow, that was a lot of fun. She goes, obviously, you really love and appreciate my husband's work. And you really brought that out with the rest of the audience. And that was really fun to be a part of. And I'm sitting there like, thank you.
Right. It goes like what we talk about with interviews all the time, right? Like when you finish an interview with somebody and they tell you that that was one of the better interviews that they've done, or they appreciated the questions that you asked, because, we take a lot of pride in it, but it's pride that only we talk about, you know what I mean?
Like,
but we take that very seriously. When someone says, oh, you're going to moderate this panel, like, we take that responsibility seriously because there are people who come to shows that want to hear that creator talk about the work that they've made and stuff like that. And so, so I was lucky enough to do a panel. I did two, outside of the podcasting one that we did. And by the way, the podcasting panel, if it's up, I'll put a link in the show notes, but the Angry Geeks podcast, they filmed it.
Yeah.
And so when Lewis lets us know that that link is up, I will put a link either in this show's show notes or the next show's show notes, and you will be able to watch that podcasting panel and us, kind of blather on about, how we do what we do. And so on Saturday, I got to host a panel celebrating, I believe it is the 30th or 35th anniversary of Craven's Last Hunt. And on that panel was artist Mike Zeck and inker Bob McLeod. And so what was interesting about these panels is that I didn't know any of these guys. Like last year when I did the Spider-Man panel, like, I had met Peter David before. I had met Dan Slott on several occasions and interviewed him on several occasions. Here, I did not know Mike Zeck. I knew his work, but I didn't know him, and I didn't know Bob McLeod, who is an amazing artist in his own right, but also is a tremendous inker as well. And so it was the two of them on this panel. And so it was celebrating Craven's Last Hunt, which is obviously one of the most beloved and greatest Spider-Man stories of all time. One of the things that makes that story special to me, and I'm not sure if this panel was recorded or not, but if it was and I find it, I will put it up so people can listen to it. But one of the things that makes that story special for me is that it's a horror story.
Yeah.
It's really a psychological horror story. And so as a horror fan, to have J.M. DeMatteis and Zach and McLeod come together and create this very dark and scary and haunting tale of, you know, Craven, who is at a point in his life where he feels like he's ready to die, but he wants to kind of go out with a bang. He wants to go on one great hunt and prove his, you know, superiority. And so what is he going to do? He's going to hunt down Spider-Man. Because at the point that this story is taking place, Craven believes that Spider-Man is like some sort of a monster. He doesn't know that he's a guy.
Mm-hmm.
He believes he's some sort of mythical, you know, superpowered creature. And so he decides that he's going to hunt down Spider-Man and he's going to beat him in battle. And then he is going to assume his identity and prove that he is a superior version of Spider-Man. And so as the story plays out, he kills Spider-Man and buries him. And as that series was playing out, like legitimately people thought that Spider-Man was dead at that point. Like he shot him at close range and then buried him. And then he becomes Spider-Man. But the way he becomes him is like he immerses himself in a room full of spiders and he's eating them and they're like dripping out of his mouth and stuff like that. And the storyline also features a villain called Vermin, which is one that Zek and I believe DeMatteis had created for Captain America. And so they brought him over into that series as well. But what's cool is that a lot of times you have these panels and you are talking to the writer of something. So to have the art team there and just really be getting their perspective on how they took DeMatteis' story and they brought that to life and how they created the atmosphere of it, which again is very dark and very foreboding and very scary and very almost like psychedelic in some ways. It's and haunting. There was a lot that went into the artwork and really creating that atmosphere and creating that vibe throughout the book. So it was really cool to talk to them. And that story is interesting because for people who don't know, Craven's Last Hunt was almost a Wonder Man story. It actually started out as a pitch for Wonder Man, and his brother, who I believe is called the Grim Reaper, was going to be the one that killed Wonder Man and sort of assumed his identity. And then it went through a couple different iterations as a pitch for a Batman story where the Joker was going to kill Batman and assume his mantle. And then it was at one point Hugo Strange was going to kill Batman and assume his mantle. And then when DeMatteis was going to take over Spectacular Spider-Man, it was going to be a storyline where there was an as yet unnamed and uncreated villain who he was going to create for that story that was going to end up, you know, defeating Spider-Man. But he settled on Craven, I believe, because he was a fan of Dostoevsky. And when he found out that Craven, who was a very not often used villain at the time, was Russian,
yep,
that is where he had the inspiration to make that a Craven story. And so it's a fascinating story. And the cool thing was, like, as you just mentioned, you know, you get off the panel and you hear some good feedback. So, you know, Mike Zek gave me a nice compliment about the panel. And then as we were kind of walking away, there was a person sitting in the front row who was saying, I'm a huge Spider-Man fan, but I've never read this story. And I have to track it down. He's like, do you know if any of the vendors here at this place are going to have that story? And I just handed him my trade and I said, here, have this. And he's like, oh, no, I can't take it. And I was like, no, you don't understand. You need to read this story.
Yeah.
This is one of the greatest Spider-Man stories of all time. But one of my favorite things about that we ended up talking about on the panel was that when you look at Dan Slott's superior Spider-Man, and when you look at the storyline where Dr. Octopus essentially became Spider-Man and became a version of him that in his mind was superior to Spider-Man, that whole storyline is very much an homage to Craven's Last Hunt. And so to me, that's one of the things that I love about Slott's writing is he's constantly paying respect to the storylines that came before him and his favorite storylines from back in the day. So great, great stuff. So I did that panel. And then the other panel that I did was a panel on the Punisher. And there are two particular stories that this creative team came together to do. It was, again, Mike Zek doing the pencils. It was John Beatty who was doing the inks. And it was Stephen Grant who was writing the story. And we talked about Circle of Blood, which is the very first ongoing solo series. It was a five-issue solo series of the Punisher from the 80s. And then they came back, I think that was 86. And then in 89, they came back and did another series called Return to Big Nothing. And so it was really focusing on their two stories of the Punisher and what they believe the Punisher to be and how they had a particular vision for who he is as a character and stuff like that. And so we talked about the Punisher movies. We talked about the different incarnations of the Punisher in comics, and we talked about their singular vision for what they wanted to do with this character. And it was really cool because there was a lot of Punisher fans there and people, you know, were asking questions and stuff. So it was, those are always fun. You know, you and I joke in that you are very improvisational when you go into those panels. You kind of go in and you get a feel for it and you roll with it. I, you know, am making a ton of nerd notes before I go in about questions that I want to ask and stuff like that. And so, but they're always a good time. And they're always something that when the panel is over, you're like, man, I'm really thankful that I got to have that experience. And so, you know, big thanks to Mitch for not only bringing us to a show like this, but putting us in a position where we can essentially interview some of our favorite creators in front of a room full of people and share these stories about how these comics affected us and how these storylines affected us. Like, that to me is something that is one of my favorite parts of doing this, in addition to the creator spotlight. And so it was super fun. And of course, we got to catch up with friends over the weekend, you know, John Cimino, Keith and Amy, our good buddy Joe Caramagna, who is writing the DuckTales comic now. If you haven't checked out the new DuckTales comic, he is writing that for IDW. But of course, lettering a million Marvel books along the way, catching up with him, Andrew Edge, seeing Dennis Budd, like seeing all of our friends at that show is always a blast. And some listeners who came by the table and, you know, were
to boo us
for the fact that Secret Identity is wrapping up, but also to kind of talk about, you know, what the show has meant to them and stuff like that. So it was a weekend that goes by in a blur.
Yeah.
And when it's all said and done and you and I are driving home and sort of reflecting on it, like, it's a show that has become, I think, more so than like a New York Comic Con now, kind of the centerpiece of our convention going year.
Yeah.
And it was a blast and it was a great show. And, you know, Mitch, who basically almost collapsed on Sunday of the show, is already thinking about next year and what he wants to do for next year. And so, man, if you're in the New England area and you haven't got a chance to catch Terrificon yet, holy cow, you should absolutely make it a priority, because whether you are there for celebrities, whether you're there for comics, whether you're there for merchandise, whether you're there for cosplay, or whether you're just there to hang out with friends and talk about the stuff that you love, that show has something for everybody.
Yep.
And it's really, really good.
And I got to spend a little bit of time with Greg Capullo.
Yes.
Who, what was interesting was I went to say hi to Mitch or something, and Greg was talking to him, and Greg looked at me and said, "What, you don't say hi to me anymore?" And I'm like, "Oh, hey, Greg." And I go, "Well, I didn't want to just assume you knew who I was or remembered who I was." And he's like, "You're the podcast guy. You interviewed me, blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "I think you just walked away." But I'm sitting there like, holy cow, he remembers me.
Yep.
And so we sat down, we did an interview, and the funniest thing was we wanted to do an interview for our music podcast, for Power Chords, because he is a diehard metalhead. So we went
always wearing Black Label Society jacket, hat, you know, whatever.
And he owns a lot of Black Label Society guitars. He's friends with Zakk Wylde, which you'll hear in this interview. But we went into a back room where it was him and Scott Snyder. And they were just autographing thousands of comics.
Yep.
Metal just came out. I picked one up. But they're just signing them. And it was a riot just interviewing Greg, having a good time. His wife is fantastic. And Scott, every so often, would yell out, like, it was almost not that he had to be part of the conversation.
But he was like the peanut gallery.
Yeah. But he's sitting there going, my 6-year-old son loves Holy Diver by Dio. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you just said that. So we'd start talking. But those two guys, They're guys that if anybody in this industry has the right to have an ego, an attitude, and just carry their divaness wherever they go, it's those two, and they're the absolute opposite.
But dude, the crazy thing too is like the fact that they were two of the guests at this show. Like that's what, when you talk about caliber of guests that were appearing, you had not only long time editors and writers and comic creators, Roy Thomas, you just mentioned, Mike Zeck, who designed the Black Spider-Man costume in Secret Wars and, you know, did this Punisher
Marv
run. Marv Wolfman was there. I mean, like, there were Peter David was there. Longtime veteran comic creators where if you have been fans of any of these characters for any length of time, you could go and see some of your idols that you read growing up. And then you have two of the biggest superstars in comics now. I mean, There's not many people you would put above on the list of comic book superstars right now than Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo.
Yeah.
So having the two of them there, I mean, their line was just constant
all weekend.
The entire time that they, but then you're bringing in Echo Kellum and Violet Bean from the CW TV shows. Lee Merriweather was there. Burt Ward was there. As I mentioned, Shannon Purser from Stranger Things, Sean Gunn from Guardians of the Galaxy was there. Chaz Palminteri.
I was just gonna say Chaz
from
Palminteri.
A Bronx Tale. My son, was like, "Dad, is that the guy from A Bronx Tale?" Yep, it sure is. Like, again, someone and something for everyone at that show, and it just gets better and better every year.
A lot of fun.
Enough cannot be said about that. So that was a super fun trip to the show. Now let's get into the news a little bit, Matthew. How about a Joker movie?
Why not?
Okay. A new movie telling the origin story of the Joker is in development at Warner Brothers, according to Deadline, with movie-making legend Martin Scorsese attached to produce, along with Todd Phillips, who produced and directed all three of the Hangover films. So really encouraging and, not so encouraging on the second one. Phillips is also slated to direct and is co-writing the script with Scott Silver, who wrote The Fighter and 8 Mile. The plan is for a Joker story separate from all other Warner Brothers versions of the character, set in early 80s Gotham City a la Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Now, what's interesting about this is that I also just read that the Batman standalone movie is going to be separate from the DC cinematic universe. So what's crazy to me is that on the Marvel side of things, there are movies that they have to keep separate from the Marvel Cinematic mm-hmm. Universe, like the Fantastic Four movie and up until recently, the Spider-Man movie, because they didn't own the rights to all these characters, and so they couldn't include them in their larger cinematic universe. The idea that DC is going to take these characters and make movies for them that are not connected to the cinematic universe that they're building – when they own all the rights to these characters and could connect them is kind of mind-boggling to me. Like, I understand that it might be set in a different era and it might be taking place long ago, but why would you not connect it to the larger universe? I don't get that.
Yeah, and it seems like they're just trying to with this because I don't care. I don't care if
I don't need a Joker origin movie.
I am not a continuity guy.
Sure.
I just want to be entertained,
right.
Whether it's my comics, whether it's my movies, anything. But it seems like this statement is saying, yeah, you know how Marvel's really connecting everything? We're not connecting everything.
Well, and it's almost like they're saying like, yes, we have this connected shared universe and we're going to continue to do movies that connect to that overall thing. But you're also going to see a lot of movies from us featuring these same characters who are not connected to the larger thing. So, it remains to be seen whether or not movie audiences will care about that. But clearly, they're feeling like Joker is a big enough property that they want to go ahead and do a standalone movie for him.
I do love Martin Scorsese, though.
Well, and the idea that he's producing...
And not directing.
Yep. Like, if you had told me he's going to do a Joker movie directed by Martin Scorsese, now you've got my attention.
Then you're going to get Taxi Driver.
Yeah, exactly. Right, like, producing it, we'll see how much he's actually involved with that. The Jetsons, Matthew, have found a new TV home. Variety reports that a live-action television series based on the space-age Hanna-Barbera cartoon scored a pilot order from ABC. Robert Zemeckis will executive produce, along with Campari Entertainment's Jack Rapke and Jackie Levine. The Jetsons are coming to comics this fall in a new 6-issue miniseries from DC Comics. Warner Brothers is also developing an animated feature as well, but the Jetsons are coming to live action television. What do you think about that?
I love the Jetsons. I think it's going to be so let me preface this by saying I thought the Flintstone movies were amazing. They might not have been the greatest stories, but I love
you know what's interesting to me is that the Jetsons were an animated primetime cartoon.
Yeah.
That in an era of live action television, just like the Flintstones were.
Yeah.
So like the Simpsons are. So the idea that they want to turn them into live action is kind of weird to me. It's like, why don't you just bring back the Jetsons as an animated series and put it on after the Simpsons?
Yeah.
As opposed to doing a live action version. Granted, I will be sitting down to watch the live action version of the Jetsons when it comes to ABC. That's happening.
Are they going to make it dark like Riverdale?
Well, I mean, Robert Zemeckis, I'm assuming that it's going to be – no, I'm assuming it's not going to be dark. I'm assuming it's going to be humorous.
Yeah.
So – which is in the vein of what the Jetsons should be. I don't need a darker version of the Jetsons.
We don't need
Jetsons.
A murder at you know, Cogswell Cogs.
Yes. So that's – exactly. Yeah, we do not need that. So let's move on because this one I think you're going to be really interested in, Matthew. Wizard World is returning to editorial content.
Huh.
Once the publisher of Wizard Magazine, which ended its two-decade print run in 2011, so that's 6 years ago, Wizard World will relaunch Wizard as part of a new digital initiative. The program will include WizPop, a daily news service focused on pop culture, entertainment, and fandom. Wizard will relaunch on August 25th during Wizard World Chicago. Brian Walton, who formerly held the position of editor-in-chief at Nerdist and VP at Legendary Digital Networks, will fulfill roles of editor-in-chief and director of content for Wizard. Nerdist and Deadline alum Luke Y. Thompson will be associate editor. Classic Wizard magazine columns, such as Casting Calls and The Drawing Board, will be revived for the digital version, which will also feature reviews, interviews, and news about comics, movies, TV, games, toys, and more. Now, we have finally revealed the real reason that Secret Identity is wrapping up its 12-year run, and that is because Wizard is stepping in to because we've sold to Wizard.
Yes,
much like everybody else did back in the day, we've sold to Wizard. What do you think about that? I find this move fascinating on a couple of different levels, but what do you think?
I do too. I want it to work. That's first and foremost. When I was reading comics for 20 years before Wizard showed up, but then I started to read Wizard because I wanted to see what was going on in the world of comics. Wizard created comic celebrities, Casting Call. That was like my favorite column in there. I would rip the plastic open and go right to that to see who was going to be picked to play, or, you know, who did they think would be a good thing. There were some great columns in there. There was a lot of fun. I used to love that it was my comic book interaction away from the comic book store.
Right.
And when Wizard, the magazine, fell apart, I could never understand why they didn't do this then. And I always never could quite understand why is Wizard still an entity when there's no Wizard,
there's no magazine
there.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it. I hope it works. I will tell you right now, I will be going to that site for the every time they update something.
Well, my initial thought when I read this was, why would anybody be getting into the comics journalism game? Journalism is dead. Like, and people don't read features anymore. Which is something I mourn on a daily basis. But then I thought to myself, oh, this makes perfect sense, because what Wizard was doing back then is what online news sites have become.
Yes.
Top 10 lists, and basically everything is BuzzFeed now.
Mm-hmm.
Top 10 people who should be cast as Batman once Ben Affleck leave. Top 10 writers who should take over Aquaman after so-and-so leaves. Like, that's what online journalism is now, and it is awful.
Yes.
And I hate it. But that is what Wizard was doing in print form years and years ago. So from Wizard's standpoint, it's like, holy crap, we get out of doing this stuff, and then all of a sudden everybody turns into what we used to do.
We created this.
We basically created this. Why don't we get back into the business? Because if we know how to take this approach, because we did it for years and years and years. So in that way, it makes perfect sense to me that they're coming in to do that. One of the sites that pains my heart to look at nowadays is Comic Book Resources, because back in the day when I used to write for Comic Book Resources, they did features. They did a lot of interviews. They did a lot of in-depth news stories. And nowadays when you go to their website, it is like BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
It's all top 10. It just kills me to even look at it now. And that happened after Jonah sold it. Jonah Weiland, who used to run Comic Book Resources and is an awesome dude, and gave me my opportunity over there and ran it with a lot of love. When the new folks came in, it's just a clickbait.
It became, you know, what Newsarama became.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it was the
Which
same
is what,
thing.
You know, and comics journalism isn't the only place where that's happening. It's all journalism.
It's everywhere.
But if you look at specifically pop culture, if you look at video game journalism, a lot of the major gaming sites are the same way now. Everything is very short, bite-sized articles because people's attention span are not that great anymore, and also that means more clicks. Everything.
And let's grab a headline that really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the story, just to get you to read
it. And everything is a slideshow where you click on a news story and then you have to click so they can show you more ads and stuff like that. We try not to focus on the negative here, Matthew, but
I hope Wizard can do this right.
I hope they can do it right as well, because I think there is plenty of room for actual comics journalism. So if there is an entity that's going to come in and cover the industry, and I don't mean in a gossipy way like some of the other sites out there do, but in a way where we are going to get more in-depth conversation with creators and stuff like that, I think there's totally room for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see more of that. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens with them moving forward. So So those are all the news stories I brought. The last thing I just want to mention is that I know some of the people that listen to this show are gamers. And recently this week, Blizzard released the latest animated short on one of their Overwatch characters. Overwatch is, of course, the team-based shooter that has become an absolute phenomenon. And they have been releasing some comic books that expand the stories of that universe. But they also have been releasing animated shorts that sort of give you the backstory of each character. There was a short that came out this week, and I'm going to send you the link to it, Matthew, before I leave here today, because you will be bawling your eyes out.
Great.
It's like freaking Pixar, dude. Like, their animated shorts are absolutely incredible, and it's so easy to see why people absolutely love this game and the characters. But even if you don't care about Overwatch and you don't play video games, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this animated short, because it is just awesome. It's just awesome, and will probably make you want to pick up the game if you haven't already. So, anyways, that's our news. Now it's time for us to get into comics. And when we went to Terrificon this past weekend, it wasn't until Sunday morning that I got to make my way around Artist Alley and start to take a look at, you know, outside of the people that I knew that were there, sort of who was presenting there. And I ran into Cody Andrew Souza, who is the creator of Croak, which is a book from Alterna Comics, which I'm actually going to talk about in an upcoming episode, because I bought the first two issues and I want to read the second one before I come and talk about the book. But it's a horror title that I absolutely dig. But this was my first chance to pick up or the first time I had picked up Alterna Comics in print. They are $1.50. They are printed on newsprint, and I think I'm in love.
Mm.
I mean, we talked about this before, but the Alterna Comics is a company that I've been kind of interested in for a while, and this is my first chance to pick up a few books. And Croak was actually one of the books that I had been looking for, and the guy's like, "Yeah, no, I created that book." I'm like, "Holy crap, dude!" Like, I've been seeing your series up on Twitter and stuff like that. But the book I want to talk about today that I picked up there is called Lilith Dark, because it not only is a great sort of all ages book, but it speaks to the D&D fan in me. So Lilith Dark, this is the first issue in a 4-issue series, and the creator of this series is and he wrote, illustrated, and created the series, Charles C. Dowd. And it is about a young girl with a very active imagination. And so as the book starts out, you hear the main character, who is Lilith, who is a young girl. She is narrating how she is scaling the mountains, to climbing the mountain of fear to fight the wicked creatures that roam within its walls. And you see her journeying across this wasteland to kind of get there. And she gets in there and she ends up confronting these like goblin creatures. And you could see she's got almost like a Thor helmet on, and she's got her cloak on. So it's very sort of D&D, you know, adventurer going into the dungeon to fight these monsters. And she finds these goblin-like creatures that she ends up battling. And she's talking through the battle about how she's, you know, smacking one with her sword on the top of the head, kicking one across the room. And then all of a sudden, all that cuts out. And you see that she is in her home, standing atop her dinner table with a bucket on the top of her head. And she's just whacked her brother in the head with a wooden sword. And her big sister is yelling at her. And she's saying, "Lilith, what on earth makes you think that it's okay to hit your brother in the head and kick meatloaf all over the place?" And you see that they have a dog named Snowball, who is eating up all the meatloaf. Her big brother Dewey and her big sister Becky are the two that have to sort of babysit and corral her. And they send her to bed early because she just made a mess of the whole downstairs. And so she's in bed and she's kind of lamenting the fact, as she's talking to her pet stuffed dinosaur, about how they just don't understand, you know, you know, she's in college and she reads books and she thinks that she's so fancy. And she's talking to her dinosaur saying, you know, I wish you were real when we wouldn't have to, you wouldn't have to follow all these dumb rules. We could do whatever we want. We could eat cake for dinner and we could go on adventures and all this kind of stuff. And she's sort of dreaming about, as she falls to sleep, the dinosaur and going on adventures with the dinosaur and stuff. And then in the middle of the night, she gets woken up by a giant thunderstorm. And a bolt of lightning hits a tree across the street, and she thinks that she sees the silhouette of some kind of creature as the lightning flashes, but then she convinces herself that that's not, you know, what it is. The next day, her sister is yelling and screaming at her because they're late for school. Her and her brother get pushed out the door, and they're waiting at the bus stop, and as she's waiting at the bus stop, she sees something scurrying over in the bushes, and so she goes, and she sees a little kitty cat. And she sees the cat run away and she's chasing this cat. Well, her brother, who is so focused on his phone, doesn't even notice that she's gone, ends up getting on the bus and going to school. And she now has missed the school bus. So she follows this kitty cat in the middle of this, you know, forest to a tree with a giant hole in it. And when the kitty cat goes down the hole, she ends up following this cat down into the tree, and it opens up into a giant cave system down below. And when they get down there, she's about to grab this cat when all of a sudden it morphs into this giant, like, cat beast. And as she is sitting there trying to figure out what's going on, she realizes that this is like one of the creatures that she dreams about. And so she kind of summons up her courage and she's going to fight this thing. And this thing is way bigger than her. And all of a sudden to her aid comes the creature that she had seen the night before when the tree was struck by lightning. And he's kind of like a lizard creature and he ends up helping her out. And the two of them end up fighting off this sort of werewolf cat together. And when they end up beating it, it turns back into a little kitten again. But she realizes that here's this lizard creature from her dream, and she starts talking to it, and she is realizing that this creature's friendly. And so they start talking, and they start talking about having adventures and stuff like that. And he ends up leading her in deeper into this series of caverns to a place where there is a whole army of monsters, and it looks like they want her to be their leader. And so really, overall, the story is about this young girl with a very active imagination who is wishing that these adventures she has in her head comes true. And lo and behold, on the way to school one morning, she finds herself in the middle of an adventure that is coming true. And so this, to me, is a great all-ages book. It's a great book about sort of fostering your imagination, and also it speaks to the D&D fan in me. So I picked up the first two issues, and I've read through both of them so far, and they're great. It's a four-issue limited series. As I mentioned before, the cover price for Alterna Comics is $1.50.
Mm.
So if you see these on the spinner rack at your local comic shop, grab them, man. For $3, you get two comics,
yeah,
which is basically the cover price for one issue for most everybody else now. So, and again, the newsprint. You got to love the newsprint. I'm a big fan of that. So, and the cool thing was, as I flipped open on like the second or third page, there was an ad for Plastic City Comic Con.
Oh, nice.
Which, of course, our friends Keith and Amy just put on a few weeks ago. So I'm a little bit behind on the first issue of this, but definitely worth picking up. And I love the whole cheaper comics on newsprint angle that Alterna is taking. Definitely going to grab more of their stuff.
How many books do they have out now?
They had at least this guy, Cody, had at least 10 of them on sale of like different titles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they've definitely got a stable of titles, I think, at this point that are at least two or three issues into each one. And most of the stuff looks like it's right up my alley.
I wished I went back and grabbed some, because now I'm thinking I would have loved to have spent 10, 15 bucks at a table and gotten a handful.
He was running a deal, 8 for $20.
Yeah, yeah. That's...
So, but we'll be talking about the Croak series too in the near future.
All right. So a series that I was a little mixed on because I did not know what to expect, and that is Mr. Miracle. If you do not know the story of Mr. Miracle, and the creative team on this one, Tom King is the writer and Mitch Gerads is the colorist, the inker, and the penciler. So it has a really, really interesting feel to it. Mr. Miracle was a character created by Jack Kirby back at the days of the New Gods.
Uh-huh.
He was, I believe he even predated the New Gods. He was somebody on Earth. He was an escape artist. And every comic was him trying to escape something crazy and exciting and nutty and really cool. And the backstory on him is even better. He is scot-free And he is the
Scott
son.
Free.
Yes, he is the son of Highfather, who is the head of New Genesis, part of the New Gods. And to keep an alliance and to keep peace between that world and Apocalypse, Darkseid switched sons with him. So Scott Free grew up on Apocalypse, and Orion grew up on New Genesis. So Scott Free, I remember reading this as a kid going, how is this dude not whacked out and messed up and angry at the world? Because basically his father gave away his birthright and sent him to hell. And
I mean,
I wouldn't be happy.
No, that's upsetting.
So this book dives into his reactions and his mental state as he is dealing with a lot of this stuff.
Now, is Tom King still writing Batman? Or is he coming off of Batman 2? So this is an addition to
it's
Batman.
It's a 12-issue series.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting because Tom King in the Batman series is taking a really deep look at sort of the psychosis of Batman.
He definitely – my take on his style so far is that he really likes to get in the head.
He's a head. He writes the heads. Yep. Yes. So the first picture, speaking of heads, is you see Scott Free sitting there. And you got a full headshot of Scott, and he's sort of talking about things and, you know, boy, you know, I'm a master of the spectacular, I'm this and that. And then you turn the page, and he is in his bathroom with his wrist slashed.
Oh.
Bleeding out all over the place.
In his Mr. Miracle costume.
And that is the other part where I'm like, huh, this is a little creepy. So it's called Meet Mr. Miracle. And it is a 12-issue series. So we start out and we see – you turn the page after you see that shocking picture. And somebody is narrating. It says – and the teacher says to the whole class, draw whatever you want. And you see a young boy who looks like a young Scott Free, and he's got the Mr. Miracle kind of uniform, almost like it's a T-shirt. And, so he's explaining to things, you know, and this is – you know, so the teacher said, what do you want to draw? And he said, I drew God. And the teacher says to him, that's very nice, but no one knows what God looked like. And the child hesitates and says, yeah, until now. So then you turn the page, and now you have Scott in an ambulance. He's being rushed to the ambulance. You see that his wrists are all wrapped up. There's a great scene of people waiting in the emergency room, and his wife, Big Barda, is in her costume.
Oh.
Sitting there waiting for results to what happened. Now, while I was reading this the entire time, Scott King had me really wondering – or Tom King, not Scott King. Tom King had me really wondering, is Mr. Miracle the same Mr. Miracle as before? Is this all been like some fixation of his imagination? He is not really from New Genesis. What was going on with this? And then when you had that little kid kind of talking about that, you were thinking, I wonder what's going on. Is this – so the first four or five pages, I'm completely confused, which I wanted – which was great. Not confused in a bad way, but so you have three, you have, each page is almost broken up into 9 equal panels,
yep.
Which I thought was pretty cool as well. Every page has a little thing that said Darkseid is.
Oh.
And then when you get closer to the end, it starts becoming more and more of the book.
Oh.
So you're getting some crazy stuff. So when you're reading about the kid saying that, you know, I've seen God, I know what he looks like, and then you see Darkseid is, it's like, uh-oh,
is Darkseid God? I'm going to guess there's a Darkseid is here or Darkseid is coming or Darkseid is close or whatever.
And he has got – obviously, that was his dad for all purposes growing up. So you're having all the things, and then Scott is laying in his hospital bed. He looks up on the TV, is Mr. Miracle saying, I can always escape. And you just see him kind of looking up completely destroyed. Then you have Barda wheeling him out of the hospital. And as he's wheeling out, you have the media running to him going, Scott, why did you do it? What's going on? Just one second. Listen. Scott, talk to us. Talk to your fans. And as he's doing that, he is picturing his hand slit, the blood going down the drain. There is a great shot of the first cover of the first Mr. Miracle comic, which is one of my favorites ever. And he's looking at all this stuff, and then you see him sitting in that bathroom on the toilet or he's sitting on the tub, hands all bandaged up. And all he's getting is he's hearing all the things that people have said to him. He's hearing things about the media.
Now, what is Barda saying to him?
So Barda is like every panel you see her, she's just broken down.
Yeah.
She does not know what to say to him.
Okay.
Which I think is another super cool part of this because Big Barda can take care of anything, and she's
always – is it
always,
like that their relationship is just not
I thought that that might be it too, yeah. But you see that Barda just loves her husband. She is there for him because I was – honestly, I was hoping it wasn't going there. Like, oh, Barda just broke up with him and he's all devastated. So you see Barda laying down on his lap as they're watching TV, and every shot and the colors are so weird. It's like a Jordy Belair.
Oh,
where you just
nice.
See the colors just kind of – they jump out at you. They're muted when they need to be. But every time you see Scott, the white wrappings around his wrists jump out. So you never forget that he tried to kill himself.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, a boom tube opens up. So because at this point, I'm still going, did he imagine this whole thing? He really wasn't in the Justice League, and he really wasn't all that. And then Orion shows up. And Orion is, like, screaming at him. He tells him to stand up. And Scott looks at him, and he goes, standing. Then Orion punches him in the face. And then I'm thinking now, is he just imagining all this because Bart is sleeping? So all of a sudden, it's three or four pages or panels of Orion just beating him up and saying, stand. He's like, I know, I'm standing, punches him again, and he's screaming, stand. And then all of a sudden, Barda goes, what the hell are you doing here? And he goes, I'm teaching. And then Barda stands next to Orion, and she's like 6-7 inches taller than him. And she's like, you're teaching? Who do you think you are? He goes, I'm Orion, the son of Darkseid. And then she goes, no, you're Orion, son of Highfather. I tend to not put you in that category because you were raised on New Genesis and the happiness and all that good stuff. We were raised on Apocalypse and the with Granny goodness and all the crap that went on. So he goes, so you know what? Why don't you go away? Because there's nothing you can't teach us that Granny didn't already teach us. So all of a sudden now I'm thinking, this is great. I'm back in. Now it's getting even more and more creepy and sad because he disappears. He goes through the boob tube, and then Scott's all beat up, and she's like, just sit down. Just don't do this. And she goes, Scott, he's always messing with you. He's always an ass. He's always been like this to you. Don't let it bother you to you. He's trying to deal with what you did on his own way. He doesn't know how to deal with the fact that his brother sort of just tried to kill himself. And he goes, Barda, your eyes, they're not brown anymore. They're blue. And then you're like, what is going on? Like, he is completely having a breakdown. And she's going, Scott, don't be crazy. It's okay. They've always been brown. And then she goes, how hard did he hit you? And then you have, like, the last couple TV appearances, and it's four pages of him on a TV show where you see, like, this cylinder, and he materializes in it and then comes out. And then the questions that he's being answered – that he's being asked are really kind of weird. And then you keep seeing the dark side is. And as the story goes on, a couple points in here I don't even want to talk about because it's just too good. If King has ever written anything that I'm falling in love with, it's this. You see Barda is really kind of struggling with everything going on. By the last few pages, as this is happening, they open up a boom tube, because they're going to go through it. And you're thinking, where are they going to go? And then Bart is looking at Scott because Scott doesn't want to go. And she's like, we got to go. And he goes, no, I can't. Something's wrong. And she goes, please, we've got to go. This is going to be, we don't want to have a final war here, but we need to go. And she go, and he's like, I've seen things. I do things that I don't know how to escape them. And then she goes, you know what? Everything is going to be all right. She smashes him in the face, knocks him unconscious, picks him up. And they walk through the boom tube, and that is where the next issue is going to begin. So a book that I did not know what to expect, a book that every three or four pages, it completely took another twist that I really like. So I'm loving this. As a fan of Scott Free, I was worried about how they were going to play this whole thing out. Now I'm not. Let King run amok and have fun with this one.
Well, we are now going to take a trip over to Boom Studios in the Boom Box imprint for a book called Hi-Fi Fight Club, Matthew. I would say if you put together Empire Records, High Fidelity, and in a way Fight Club, but it's a different kind of Fight Club, that sort of gives you an idea of what you're doing here. And as two guys who love our local music store, I think this is a book that you would enjoy as well. It is created and written by Carly Usden, pencils by Nina Vacueva, inks by Irene Flores, colors by Rebecca Nalty, letters by Jim Campbell, and the editor is Shannon Waters. It starts off in New Jersey in 1998, Matthew. And you have a 17-year-old girl who is running to get to work. Her name is Chris. And she is running to get to work, and she ends up tripping and falling. And the person that catches her before she smashes her face on the ground is a 17-year-old by the name of Maggie, who Chris, she really has a crush on Maggie. And you find out that the two of them work together at a local record store called Vinyl Mayhem.
Mm.
So you could tell that Chris, being the younger of the two, has a crush on Maggie because Maggie's much more self-confident and Chris is still kind of, you know, figuring herself out. And she has just gotten a job at this record store, and she's listening to a CD Walkman that she drops on the ground, but her CD didn't get scratched. And she goes in, and you see that at this particular record shop, there is a 19-year-old by the name of Dolores, who is kind of the goth of the crew. You have Kennedy, who's 18 years old. She is like the cool kid of the crew. And then you have the owner, who is Irene, who is 24 years old. And so it is this group of young women who all work at this music store together. And Chris is the new kid on the block. So she's coming in, and the first thing that happens is she goes into the locker room in the back where they're sort of putting their stuff down. And everyone else has, as you would back in the day, pictures from different rock magazines and stuff like that all over their lockers and stuff. And Chris's is kind of bare. And so she turns around, and Maggie gives her a copy of Spind magazine.
Spind.
And it has this cover story on this band that they like and stuff. And so she's kind of trying to help her get acclimated to being the new kid there. But also Chris is trying to figure out, wow, does Maggie like me the way that I like her? I'm not really sure yet. So she's not only figuring out her place in this relationship, but also her place in this business with all of these other people. And at 17, obviously, she's got a lot going on. And so you see a lot of them kind of hanging out in the music store and her kind of lamenting the fact that all of these other coworkers that she has, they all know who they are, you know, and you go through, you know, you've got the goth, you've got the sort of popular kid in school, you've got the cool kid, you've got this 24-year-old woman who is running this record store and is in charge of her own business and all this kind of stuff. And so she's kind of saying, well, when am I going to figure out what the heck I'm doing? And so as the day goes on, when it gets time to wrap up for the evening, everybody's closing up shop and everybody is going to stay and work after hours except for Chris. Because when Chris says, oh, I'll stay and help clean up or whatever, because they have a band that's going to come make an appearance the next day at the store. And the owner says, no, you know what? You go home. We got this. We're all set. And so Chris is kind of feeling like she is the odd one out because she didn't get invited to stay afterwards. And so she's like, you know, why, what do they not think I can help do whatever needs to be done? Or so she's kind of a little bit down. She walks out of the store. Her dad picks her up from work. And of course, her dad is like the earnest father who is like, hey, I was work today, you know, this kind of stuff. And she doesn't really want to talk about it and stuff like that. And so when she goes into work the next day, there, it's a big day because this band called Stegosaur is going to be, or Stegosour, is going to be making an appearance here, and it's one of everybody's favorite bands, and they're like a local hit, and they're going to be making an appearance in the store, so it's going to be a big day for the store. So she shows up, and her friend Maggie is also getting there at the same time, and she noticed that Maggie has bandages on her hands, and she's like, oh, did you get that riding your bike here? And she's like, oh yeah, sure, and she kind of laughs it off, and they go in, and they have set up the whole store with instruments and stuff so the band can come in and play, and there's a line gathering outside. And all of a sudden, the band is late. And when the band does finally show up, it's only three of the members, and their lead singer, Rosie, is missing. And they're like, Rosie's gone. We haven't seen her since yesterday afternoon at band practice. We don't know what's going on. So they have to cancel the band's appearance. And everybody's obviously all upset and everything. And Chris is kind of wondering what's going on. And the owner of the store, Irene, says to Chris, all right, I guess you better come with us. It's time for you to finally know what's going on. And against the protests of one of the other girls, they decide to show Chris why they wouldn't let her stay the night before. And it's because when one of them pushes a button on the jukebox, there is a secret stairway that goes down into the basement. And when they get down in the basement of Vinyl Mayhem, she finds out that the girls that work at the store are part of a vigilante fight club. And they go out and right wrongs at night, and they think that the disappearance of Rosie has something to do with this particular club. And so that's how the first issue ends, is that they have just sort of revealed themselves to Chris, and now she's being invited to be part of the club. It is a story that, again, very much has that mid-90s Empire Records sort of feel to it, where there's a lot of emphasis on, you know, kids figuring themselves out, yep. relationships, love of music, and where music sort of fits in your life at that particular time, which I think is something that you and I absolutely identify with as that being a huge part of our lives. So I think if you're a music fan and music holds that sort of special place for you, you're going to love this series. Like, it definitely resonated with me on that level for sure. And the artwork is great, and the storyline moves across, you know, real quickly. And obviously there's an element of sort of Scooby-Doo and Fight Club all mixed in as well. So very good first issue. We'll definitely be checking out more of this series.
So my final book I'm going to be talking about is a book that I paid $8 for.
Whew.
Saw this one on the shelf, didn't even know it was coming out, and then realized I don't care about the price. I needed to have it. And that is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Usagi Yojimbo, written and drawn by Stan Sakai. So I had to get this one. At the panel, I even started off by talking about that, and Stan was kind of joking around about the price tag. This came out on the heels of the Tales of the TMNT series that is now on Nickelodeon. I don't know if they have a two series going right now.
Or if this one just replaced the old one,
yeah,
maybe?
But there is the first three episodes are a Usagi crossover.
And is that storyline what's captured
very
in
very much like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, okay.
It is a fantastic – seeing Usagi walking around – and talking and fighting was so cool to see. I haven't seen the other two parts yet. But opening this sucker up, and again, this is going to be a little weird because it's in color. Usagi's always been in black and white. So to see him in color, other than the cover, is a little weird.
Now, did he color this as well?
Tom Luth did.
Okay.
Tom colors the covers, any of the inside interiors that need any bit of coloring. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 9 covers.
Wow.
And I picked up the Stan Sakai one.
Of course.
So we start out with, and I didn't even bring it with me to get it signed. So we start out with Usagi chopping some bad dudes up, much like he does. And as he is taking these guys down, there's a group, there's 4 villagers that are looking, and they're like paralyzed as they're watching Usagi take these guys down because they're just coming at him. And Usagi is a master fighter. And they're like, get him. He's only one guy. And kill him, kill him. And nobody can even touch him. He is chopping these dudes up. And then you see that it was a group of family of 4 that were walking that these guys just happened to jump. And, you know, Usagi's like, thank you so much for that. And he's like, yeah, you know, this is what I do. I protect anybody that needs help. And they're like, do I know you? And he says, no, but we knew you'd come and rescue us. And it says this section of the road is infested by bandits. The old one, assured us that you would come and protect us. So we walked down this road, and he's like, the old one? They said, yeah, the old one. He's expecting you. It's in the cave by the Green Grotto. Now, I don't know what a Green Grotto is, but I'm not going to go there if somebody says, go find the old dude because he's waiting for you. So Usagi's like, huh, he's waiting for me, so I better go and find out. And the people walk on their own. And a really cool thing about the world of Usagi is everywhere running around and walking around, there are these little dinosaurs, little teeny tiny dinosaurs.
Yep.
And somebody asked during the panel, and I kind of forgot about this. Somebody said, why are there those little dinosaurs? And somebody named what type of dinosaur it was. And Stan said, in this world where animals are people, I need to have something that kind of fills the void of wild animals walking around.
Yep.
And he goes, so I love dinosaurs, so I made a dinosaur. And as he gets in the cave, there's
simple as that, Matthew.
It's real simple. There is an earthquake, and all of a sudden he is hearing a voice saying, you're late. And he goes in, and he sees that it is a rat. And the rat is named Kakira Sensei. So he's like, you know, what do you want me for? And he says, you're late. And he goes, well, I didn't know you were expecting me. And he says, I require your help once again, Usagi. He says, I carry the most valuable object, which must be delivered to a shrine. And as they start walking, he says, there's no one here who knows this mission, but you do. And you need to, you know, help me with this. And he goes, okay, but what I'm going to do is I am going to give you 4 bodyguards. And the rat you see is like Splinter. It's a version of Splinter.
Sure.
And he goes, I'm going to give you four bodyguards. So he goes, but I need you to go into the river and pull out some turtles. And he pulls out four turtles, puts them down, and the rat goes into a trance, goes all white-eyed, and then he says some incantation with more success than Bruce Campbell did, and all of a sudden the four turtles show up. And it's really cool to see the turtles drawn in Stan style because there is a little bit of a difference.
And it's taking place in Usagi's world. Yeah.
So they're like, what's going on? What's happening? And they're like, hey, that rat looks like Splinter. And then, of course, hey, take a look at that giant bunny. And they start making fun of him. They're like, what are you doing here? You're a talking big rabbit. And Usagi's like, you're four turtles that are talking. And you're talking Japanese, by the way. So they're all freaked out about that. And then one by one, they go after him. And since Usagi's better than all of them, he takes them all down.
Sure.
And then he finds out that what they need to do, because the rat Splinter character says, you are my turtles, but you're from a different reality than the last time I called you forth. And then one of the turtle, they're like, oh, he speaks English. He goes, no, they're speaking my language. This is just how you're understanding and hearing it. He says, I called you because you need to accompany me on this journey. And what ends up happening is they talk about this fairy tale about this rock. And if this rock, it's great because he goes, I'm going to show you what can hold this universe together. And he pulls out a rock and everybody goes, oh, gasp, gasp, gasp. And then the next panel's like, wait a minute, it's just a rock.
Yep.
And he goes, it's no ordinary rock. If I don't complete this task, this land will be destroyed. And he explains how a samurai fought a big, huge fish, jumped in the middle of it. And when there was an explosion, this was all that was left of that great samurai. And this mythical fish was this rock. And the rock chipped off of this bigger rock. They need to put this rock back because this is what's holding Japan together for the most part.
Okay.
So they go on this mission and they come across the demon. And the demon is this dark cat that Usagi knows. And he's putting a band together because he doesn't want the turtles and the rabbit to put everything back together. Because if they do, then that means his power is diminished on Earth. So you get, for the next 10 or 15 pages, this major battle where everything is going on. And it is just beautiful to see. You see the fighting going on. Every time somebody dies, there's like the word balloon with a skull head.
Yeah.
That signifies that, and Stan explained where that came from. And he's like, well, somebody died at the bottom of a gully, and you didn't know that they died. And, I didn't want to offend younger audiences.
Right.
So I just drew this little skull coming out. Now I do it for everything. At the end of this, they finally are able to get rid of the bad guy. They get the rock. They put the rock back into place, and the entire city is now saved. And then the last part is a really, really, really sweet part where you've got the Splinter guy and I call him the Splinter guy because it's not necessarily
it's a different,
Splinter.
Yeah.
But you've got him and he is talking to the turtles saying, all right, you guys got to go back now. And they're like, well, we kind of like it here. This is fun because we don't have to hide from anybody. We are out and about. The only thing people freak out about is that we're turtles. Because there's not a lot of turtles walking around. So we kind of want to stay here. And they're like, well, you know what? You need to go back. And he says, but if I need you, I'll call you again. So they go back and they're like, oh, we look forward to seeing you again. They go back. They turn into little turtles. Usagi collects them and brings them back to the pond he got them at. But there is one part where it is probably one of the most beautiful panels of any comic I ever saw. And Usagi picks up one of the turtles and says, thank you for saving my country.
Oh, that's nice.
And then he puts him down. He walks away. And then Splinter Guy says, until I need you again. And that's how the issue ends. But
very cool.
Freaking amazing. And that last panel, I didn't mention that to Stan because I would have blubbered like an idiot and started crying. But I do not ever, ever want to say I got my value by paying $8 for a comic book. But it's a lot of pages. This is probably 2.5 comics in
sure.
one. And definitely, definitely something. If you like either property, read it because it's just fantastic.
And it's a one and done, which is
one
perfect.
And done.
So there you go. All right. Well, those are our comics for this week. And that is actually going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. However, in our next episode, we will be getting back to our summer reading project, which is the Summer of Dread. So for homework, if you haven't done so already, you want to be reading in the Complete Case Files Volume 1, The Killer Car Saga and the Oxygen Board story. If you read those two for next time, that's what we'll be covering. That's going to do it for this episode. So until next time, for Matthew Herring, for Brian Letendry, we're signing off. We will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.